Hello and welcome to Launch. We are broadcasting live from Hotlanta, Georgia. I'm Ron Reardon. I'm joined in the studio by my co-host, Bill McHenry. Good morning, Bill. How are you today?
Good morning, Ron. How are you today?
I'm doing super duper.
Awful warm here in Atlanta.
I'll tell you what, it's a scorcher. I can't wait till wintertime gets here again. Well, you know, Bill, on Launch, we feature innovators, entrepreneurs, related industries, providing our listeners with the opportunity to learn from both the successes and the failures of launching an idea and the long, long journey that follows. You know, this morning we're featuring Seth Levy, you know, of Devis Wright and Tremaine. But before we get started, Bill, could you thank today's sponsor?
Sure, Ron. Our sponsor today is Patents and More. Patents and More, protecting your innovation and connecting you to the resources you need for success.
That's great. Well, you know, Bill, give us some background on our guest today.
Well, Ron, Seth Levy is a patent attorney with a background in biological engineering. One of the very interesting things is he's also an inventor himself. Seth is a frequent lecturer on topics pertaining to intellectual property law. He chairs the Life Sciences Practice Group at the international law firm of Devis, Wright, and Tremaine. And he's based in the firm's Los Angeles office. And he was kind enough to get up this morning, and it's awful early out there today, Ron.
I'm sure it is. Well, Seth, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Seth, tell us a little bit about what a patent is and what it takes to protect it.
Well, sure. Well, a patent is a right to exclude others from doing certain things with your technology. It's not a monopoly. That's one of the words that we have to not use when we start dealing with the world of patents. But it's a right for someone to prevent others from making, using, selling, or importing their invention. It's a right that's granted from the U.S. government or, in cases of foreign patents, from foreign governments. It lasts for about 20 years. And the concept is that someone gets this important right in exchange for sharing all of the details of their invention. So the philosophy of patents is that if you provide all of this information and detail about your technology, then after your right of exclusion expires, other people out there in the world can see how it is that you make and use your technology so they can improve upon it and move science forward.
So, Seth, what would I need to do to get a patent, and how long does it take, and how much would it cost me?
Sure. Well, there are basically three things you need to get a patent. There are three standards. One is that you need to have an invention that is new. It's novel. So that means that nobody has done it before, nobody's described it before, nobody has put it up on their website before, so what you've done is new. The second is that your invention needs to be non-obvious. This is the tougher standard that keeps your friendly neighborhood patent attorney employed because it's a trickier thing for people to navigate. This standard has to do with the fact that your invention may be new, but would it be obvious to somebody who's skilled in this field, who's trying to solve the same problem with the same resources available? So getting over that hurdle can be a little trickier. And the third thing is that your invention needs to, you need to be able to describe your invention with words, pictures, details, in such a way that someone else can read your patent and make and use your invention. So this really separates a fully baked invention from a concept that would be nice to have someday, but we're really not sure how to execute it.
Sounds like it'd take forever.
It does, right? you know, it can take longer than some people expect. I'd say, you know, on average, you can get through the patent process in maybe 2 to 4 years. You know, some things move a little quicker, some things move a little more slowly. You know, no time like the present to get started, right?
Sure, sure.
So how much does it cost? I mean, does the cost vary with the complexity or...?
Yes, it can. I'd say, you know, it's always hard to pin these things down, but I'd say that if you're an inventor with a relatively straightforward technology that you're looking to get patented, you know, you could be looking at as much as $10,000 or $20,000 into the patent process to get this thing through. You know, unfortunately, a lot of that is things like patent office fees and the charges to get drawings made and all sorts of other things, but need to go into the patent process. But, you know, I guess two things to bear in mind is that these are costs that tend to be incurred over a period of years because it does take a while to get through the process. And the other is, you know, as I counsel people all the time, it's sort of a you get what you pay for kind of a situation. There are plenty of opportunities for people to either go at the patent process themselves or to try to, you know, do more of the work on their own and just have someone file it for them. But you always run the risk that if you're not working with someone who's familiar with these processes, you can really wind up with something that it's nice to hang on your wall at the end of the day, but it really may not afford the intellectual property protection that you need. So,
Seth, as an inventor yourself, how did you go about deciding to file for a patent? And do you want to share with our audience a little bit about your inventions?
Sure. You know, and my case was a little strange, and this is something that people who work in the patent space have the risk of doing. You know, my background's in biological engineering, and I tend to work with, you know, inventors large and small, from, you know, individuals who come up with great ideas to larger companies. And this was actually a situation where I had been working with a company for quite some time. And, you know, sometimes it's just hard to take off your engineering hat when you're working with people and, you've come up with a great idea yourself. So in this particular case, I had stepped out of my role of patent attorney for a moment and put my engineering hat back on and it helped the company to develop some additional technology. So, you know, in my case, it was, you know, a little unusual in that I think the company was interested in protecting the ideas that I had suggested as opposed to something I developed entirely independently.
Oh, okay.
Well, Seth, you talked about 2 to 4 years, you know, for the patent to actually issue. Does an inventor have to just kind of sit on their hands during that 2 to 4 years, or is there something that they can be doing during that process?
Well, there are several things they can be doing, and it's a very good question. You know, for one, from the moment you start the patent process, you can say that you have a patent pending, and that can hold some weight in different situations. It's just a nice thing to be able to say. There are some things that can move the patent process along a bit. You know, for example, when we start hearing things back from the patent office, we can respond quickly as opposed to waiting to the end of every period we have for response, because, of course, the faster we move, the faster the process goes. But, you know, there's only so much we can do to control the patent process itself. Separate from that, what people can be doing is really thinking strategically about moving their product forward. You know, once we have a patent application filed, it's often the case that people are ready to go market their product or sell it online or do whatever it is they're going to do. You know, there's often no reason to wait for the patent to issue before we move our business forward. What becomes important is really being sure that whatever we're doing on the business side is aligned with what we're doing on the patent side, so that neither process gets in the way of the other or jeopardizes some of our strategy.
Okay. Well, you know, you talked about earlier that, you know, the three things, the last one was that you need to have enough detail in there that somebody could make and use the invention after the patent expired. If I had come up with a way of turning lead into gold, and I said that the process was to pick up a bar of lead, put it in a bowl, then do some chemistry stuff, and then remove the bar of gold, is do some chemistry stuff enough detail?
You probably need a little bit more than that.
A little bit more detail, huh? So it can't be just an idea on a napkin. It really needs to be fleshed out a little bit then.
Yeah, that's right. And this is another one of those tricky standards because, you know, how much is enough? You know, on the one hand, what we need to be able to describe, the legal standard here is that we have to have enough detail so that somebody else who's skilled in this field can read what's in our patent and they would have enough information to make and use our invention. That doesn't mean they need to know why it works or, you know, what, you know, mysterious things are really going on in the chemistry, but we've got to be able to write it almost like you'd read in a cookbook, you know, add half a cup of water and bake for, you know, 30 minutes, and as long as we can follow those steps and get the same result, we've met our burden.
Okay, but following your analogy of a cookbook, if it's something that's really well known, you probably don't have to go into detail. Like if it says separate two eggs, you don't have to talk about how to separate two eggs because any kind of cook would know exactly how to separate two eggs. You know?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Seth, tell our audience about the success of once you finally do get a patent, how many people are successful?
Successful in getting
well,
the patent?
Well, launching and usually people can get their patent, but then after they receive the patent, how many of those patents are then successful and are able to be in the commercial area, not just retail, but commercially sold?
Sure. That's an excellent question, but a tough one to answer. I think, I wish I could give you a number. I'd say that, I guess what I could say is the people who can commit to the patent process and really focus on what's important for patent protection within their product are probably going to have the best chance of success. And that's not, it's a tough numbers game to play, but I think the place where people can run into trouble is when they have either unrealistic expectations about what the patent process can bring or where, the business and the patent divert over a period of years, because we start today with what may be a great idea. We start the patent process, everybody's off and running, and then 3, 4, 5 years later when the patent issues, we realize the business went to the left and the patent went to the right, and now we have that discontinuity, which makes it difficult because our patent may no longer read on our product.
Sure.
Well, there's been a lot of buzz, Seth, recently about provisional patents as opposed to non-provisionals. What exactly is a provisional? Is there such a thing as a provisional patent, or is it really provisional patent application?
There's really a provisional patent application and not a patent, and this is one of the nice tools that's out there for people, but it's often misunderstood. So a provisional patent application is really just a placeholder in the patent office. It's a limited opportunity to put a stake in the ground, describe what our invention is, and secure a filing date in the patent office, which can be important for several reasons. But provisionals only last for a year. They're never examined. They don't have many of the same formal requirements that a standard patent application would have. But it can be sent off to the patent office, usually a bit more quickly than the standard patent application that takes a bit more time to prepare. Oftentimes the benefit of these things is a few things. One, it can be very important to secure a filing date in the patent office because the timing of initiating the patent process with respect to when we are going to publicly disclose our invention are important things to balance. So in the United States, we have a one-year grace period from the first time we publicly disclose our invention to the date on which we have to start the patent process. For most of the rest of the world, there is no such grace period. So in either case, it becomes important to figure out exactly when we're going to start the patent process so that we don't inadvertently undermine what we were trying to do by describing or selling our invention before timely starting the patent process. So a provisional can be a quick way to do that if need be. The other is that provisional applications don't publish. So if we want to start the patent process and give ourselves some time to really think through if we're going to move forward with the patent process or what we're going to do with our business, this can be a nice way to start the process and get the ball rolling, but without fully committing to the patent process just yet and some of the costs and other things associated with it. If we decide not to do anything with our provisional, it goes away in the patent office and nobody's the wiser. So that can be a nice way to balance things when we're just getting started.
So, Seth, is my product patent pending as soon as I file for the patent application?
Yes, it is. Whether you start it as a provisional or a regular application or whichever kind you choose, it's pending the moment you file.
In my travels, I have a lot of people asking me about international patents. And that's really confusing for me. Can you tell our listeners more about international patents, the cost, and, do you have it in every country? And, of course, people talk about China stealing it. And Can you comment on those?
Sure, sure. Well, just like there's a provisional patent application but no provisional patent, there's also an international patent application process, but there's no international patent. So patent rights are something that need to be secured on a country-by-country basis, or in some cases there are regions that grant patents, like Europe. But they do need to be done separately. So there are some mechanisms you can use to coordinate that process and that add a little more efficiency to the process and frankly, reduce costs. But it becomes important to figure out what our business objectives are going to be with our technology so we can think through countries that would be useful in the patent process.
How do you help an inventor decide or an entrepreneur decide what countries, Seth?
Yeah, you know, I guess a couple things to keep in mind. I mean, for one, where are you going to sell your product? Where are your major markets? I think Bill, you'd mentioned China, and that's, of course, an enormous market, and people are talking more and more about it all the time. Would patent rights be helpful there? Is this an intellectual property right you really would want to enforce, or are you willing to go at it another way, just try selling the product and not be so concerned about knockoffs, not because they aren't something to be concerned about, but they may not be something you're well situated to do anything about. So really thinking in terms of what opportunities you want the patent process to afford you down the road. You should also be thinking in terms of where you're manufacturing this. Even if you're not selling it somewhere, perhaps you're manufacturing this overseas, and that's something that can be controlled through patenting. And importation is another thing, and this is, sort of works backwards because, for example, if I have a patent in the U.S., I can prevent others from importing into the U.S. something that infringes my patent. So going back to our China example, it may be that I'm very concerned about people knocking off my goods in China, but if I have the ability to stop things at the border because I have my U.S. patent, that may be sufficient. And maybe a Chinese patent is not something that I need to be concerned about.
International patents, and if you decided you wanted to do a patent in every country in the world, how many, is it 160 countries that you do 160 patents, or how does that work?
Yeah, it can get that way.
Okay.
If you're really going to every country in the world, that's going to be an expensive proposition.
Okay.
I can tell you, I used to work for one of the larger pharmaceutical companies. I was in-house there when I started my career, and when we would file things around the world, it was an event. You were really filing things around the world.
That's when you told me you had to do it all at the same time. Didn't you tell me that in a discussion?
Yeah, as you reach certain dates in the process, now, of course, mind you, this was some years ago, so it was before I could fire off an email to, 160 people at once and coordinate things that way. But even so, it's an enormous expense, and it's a lot of things to coordinate. So I think the message in this day and age, especially when it is a global economy and people are going to want to sell products in lots of places, is to be selective. You probably don't need a patent in each and every country around the world, but I bet there are a handful of major markets that are of interest, and if they're not of interest to you directly, then maybe to business partners that you're going to have. So think through what that small handful of countries might be.
Yeah, because I would think that you wouldn't really need patent protection in Lower Slobovia or Liechtenstein and places like that.
Yeah, and not knocking Liechtenstein. I'm sure it's a huge market for some things.
That's right.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, if you're going to cost yourself more in patent protection than you're ever going to earn in sales, then there's probably something that's out of whack. So.
Yeah. Well, I know we've talked about the utility patents, but I know there's also design patents, and I see design patents for toys and for housewares and even cars and stuff like that. When is it appropriate to either go with a design instead of a utility or design plus a utility?
That's an excellent question. So patents do come in different flavors, and this is one of those things that's a bit different in different places around the world, too. So in the U.S., there are actually three kinds of patents that you can get. There are utility patents, which is what we see most of the time. There are design patents, as you say, and there are plant patents, and plant patents have to do with new breeds of plants, so I'll kind of skip over that for the moment, but it is out there. The difference between utility and design is that utility patents protect the functionality of your invention. It's the method of using it. It's the gadget itself, what it does. A design patent strictly protects its ornamental appearance, regardless of what it does. So very often, inventions have both a unique look to them and they have a unique functionality to them. And whether to pursue one or the other or both really comes down to the nature of the invention. The reason you see designs very often in things like consumer goods, footwear, even things like cars, other products, is that there are, you know, oftentimes the functionality of our invention isn't what's new. It's really how the thing looks. It's the appearance that's something exciting. Design patents are also a whole lot cheaper to obtain, and they can generally get through the patent process, you know, within a year or two at the outside. So this can be a nice way to get more quick and easy patent protection to at least start building that patent arsenal we want to have for our products. So, you know, in terms of when it's appropriate, it's when there's something that is different about what our invention looks like.
You know, as I read the papers too, Seth, lately there's been a lot of press on the patent office and patent law and so on. Could you comment to our listeners on some of the changes and some of the things that are going on with the patent office and the various patent laws?
Sure. You know, the patent law was a career for a long time where nobody really paid much attention to it outside of patent lawyers. But the last several years, there's been a great deal of press. There have been Supreme Court cases, which was not something we frequently had, rule changes, then pending changes in the patent laws themselves in Congress. There's been a lot going on. So I'd say some of the bigger things happening now, any day now we're expecting the Supreme Court to come down with a decision in the Bilski case. And this really has to do with a very fundamental question of patent law, which is, what is patentable? Which doesn't get a whole lot more fundamental than that. And the issue in Bilski was, has to do with business methods and will likely have an impact in other areas too. That particular technology had to do with hedging risks and commodities trading and things, but the impact is likely to be broader.
You said it was the Dolsky case, Seth?
Bilski.
Bilski. B-I-L-S-K-E-Y.
Oh, okay. Is there a way our listeners could look that up in the patent office to learn a little more about that?
Yeah, if you
Not
Google
that I want to do that, Seth. I just think maybe our listeners may want to.
Sure. Yeah, I think if you Google the words Bilski and patent, you're going to come up with plenty of things.
Okay.
But yeah, this case will come down any day now, and I'm sure when it does, there's going to be a fair amount of press because it really is, like I said, a fundamental question about, what kinds of things are patentable, and the particular issue here is that the Federal Circuit has established a standard for patentability that's a little challenging. It has to do with really tying an invention to some machine or physical transformation. And I can tell you, as a practitioner, I've seen a lot of communication now from the patent office in a number of cases I'm handling where the examiners are looking to this standard and applying it in a fairly rigid way, as they perhaps should do based on the current standard, but it's causing some real confusion among practitioners and examiners alike about, is this invention patentable, even if it met all those standards that I talked about before? So that's really a fundamental issue right now, and I think in our biotech side of the world, we saw an outgrowth of this in the ACLU case that was in New York a few months ago, having to do with whether our genes are patentable. And that caused quite a stir in the medical community and patient advocacy groups, but it relates to the same fundamental issue of what is patentable. So I think we're going to see some interesting guidance on that soon.
And when you say genes, Seth, you're not talking about Levi's, right?
Right. Those you get your design patents, right?
That's right. But you're talking about the things that make up the composition of the body, right?
That's right.
Okay. Well, what's really the difference between licensing a patent and selling a patent?
Sure. A patent is an intellectual property asset, and an intellectual property is like any other form of property. It's like your house or your car. It doesn't sit on the ground and you can't drive it around. But you can do the kinds of things with a patent that you would do with your house or your car. You can sell it, you can loan it to someone, you can do all those kinds of things. So patents are usually, or rights in patents are usually transferred to other people in one of two ways. You can either sell your patent to them, and that generally goes whole hog. You just hand it on over in exchange for some price, and that's often a straightforward kind of thing. It means we don't retain any rights in the patent. We don't control anything about the patent. We're just giving it to somebody else in exchange for something. A license is really everything else, and they come in many, many different variations, because with a license, what that means is we're taking our patent and we're giving to somebody else some of the rights associated with the patent, but not all of them. When we sell, we give all of the rights. When we license, we do something less than that. So we may license the right to manufacture our product, but not sell it. We may license the right to sell our product in 5 states, but not the other 45. We can slice and dice things however it is we might like. We can non-exclusively license our patent to 5 different people so that each of them has the ability to use the technology. And generally in return, we get things like perhaps a royalty or a payment of some form. Maybe we get a license in return to some of their intellectual property. But there's some transaction there where we're giving some of the rights associated with our patent and we're getting some value in return.
Okay. Well, is there such a thing as patent strategy, Seth, to having just one patent, multiple patents, a mixture of design and utility and follow-on patent applications? I mean, how is that done?
Sure. The patent strategy is all about the business. And I think it's, in my experience anyway, I like to start with, where do we want our business to go? And then let's build an IP strategy from there. So, the short answer is there absolutely can be and should be a patent strategy, even if the strategy is, patents are too expensive, let's not worry about them now. That's a strategy. But we need to be thoughtful about that. So there are ways that we can work through the patent process to have things like you had suggested, which is a combinations of utility and design patents. We can file patents in such a way that we try pursuing many of them all at once, or we can try to stagger them over a period of time. We can pursue things internationally or not. We can pursue some things internationally and some things not. I mean, it's absolutely an a la carte kind of situation that really needs to be tailored to the technology we're dealing with and the business we hope to have. So, we may, in sort of the advanced situation, we may think in terms of things like, where are our competitors? Do we want to obtain patent rights in places that might trip up our competition to give us some advantage? Or are there things that we may want to patent that relate to our technology? They're our good ideas, but they aren't the product that we will ultimately commercialize. But, there could still be value in building a patent portfolio that's broader than just the one thing we're looking to bring to market. So all of those kinds of factors need to be taken into account. And I think the takeaway message I'd like to leave with people is to, just remember to keep this in the back of your mind as you're developing your marketing plan, as you're developing your business strategy, or however it is you're going to finance your operation, that we should always be thinking in the back of our minds, how does this impact our IP strategy, and is there something we should be maybe thinking about here before we make that, do that deal or pull that trigger or make whatever decision?
So you really have to think about it, it sounds. Seth, one of the things I've always get asked is enforcing my patent, and how do I handle people that are infringing on it? And especially goes back to my questions about the international patents. Can you tell our listeners a little bit of about that?
Sure. To start with, there are no patent police, right? So enforcement is something that is entirely the issue of the patent holder. So, step one, of course, is even identifying that infringement is going on. But if we find someone out there who's clearly infringing our product, then it's up to us to move forward in enforcing it somehow. So usually the way this goes is that we start a letter writing campaign, dear friendly infringer, you might not be aware that I have this, very well-written patent over here and thought you might like to see it, and maybe we can discuss a business opportunity. So we have to sort out, what we want from this person. Do we want to stop them from selling the product or doing whatever they're doing that's infringing? Or do we want to maybe license our technology to them and let them continue doing what they're doing, but at a price? So this is part of the strategic issues that need to be sorted out. But if this is someone we want to stop, then we would wind up going off to court if our letter-writing campaign isn't successful, and patents are enforced in the federal courts. And it can be, this too can be an expensive proposition at times. So it becomes a real question of whether it's going to be important to us to enforce this to the extent of litigation, or is it something that we want to stop short of. One thing I will caution people is that letter-writing campaign can start the train going down the tracks in ways that can be difficult to stop. And there were some cases about this over the last few years where just sending that letter to the other side, if it's written in a sufficiently aggressive way, may give the recipient of that letter an ability to go to court and challenge your patent. So you may wind up being brought to court as opposed to being the one who gets to decide whether or not to initiate those types of proceedings.
Just by the letter that you send?
Just really? By the letter you send. So you need to be very thoughtful about, how hard do we want to push? Is this something we really want to do? And, is the recipient of this letter the kind of person or the kind of company who might be equally aggressive in return before we start making a lot of noise? So these are all things to be thinking about before we, start doing these things. But, but again, why get a patent if you're never going to enforce it? So
sure.
It's just a balancing.
So it sounds like the watchword is really think very, very thoughtfully and carefully before you act.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And, a lot of great thought must have gone into things early on or we wouldn't have gotten this great patent. So if we're an innovative person and we're developing great ideas and technology, then we should be equally innovative in how we're protecting that IP and enforcing it.
Right. Well, Seth, this has really been great. How can our listeners get in touch with you and your firm if they want to go forward?
Sure, thanks. They can find us on the web at dwt.com, or they can always email or call me. I can give you that information if you'd like.
Sure, please.
Sure. My email is SETHLEVY at DWT.com, or it can be reached in our Los Angeles office at 213-633-6800.
Okay. Well, Seth, thanks so much for being on our show today, especially getting up at 0:30 there in Los Angeles.
My pleasure. This was great.
Okay. Well, our listeners really have gotten some great nuggets and learnings that they can use in their launch and their journey, especially when they look at patenting.
Terrific. I'm glad to hear it.
Okay. Well, another great show, Bill.
Yes, it was really a great run, and I want to have a special thanks to today's sponsor, Patents & More, your trusted guide through the innovation jungle.
Yeah, and tune in each week at this same time to listen live, or you can go to our website, thelaunchhour.businessradiox.com, to listen at your convenience. Until next week, this is Ron Reardon, Bill McHenry, signing off another great session of Launch.